Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Jody Sanders.
And I'm Todd Smith.
And our guest today, we're extremely honored. We have former Texas Supreme Court Chief Justice Wallace Jefferson. Chief Justice, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited about it.
Right before we started, Todd and I were kind of chatting with you. I think you're now our third chief to be on here, but we're excited. You've been on our list since we started to be one of our guests. So we're glad 6 years in, we finally can get you on. You know, I think the majority of our listeners know who you are, but I don't know, maybe they don't know about your background, anything like that. So maybe just kind of give us your background and your path to the bench.
Just starting from my family, my father was in the military, United States Air Force. He and my mother had six kids. None of us were born in Texas because he was traveling all over the country from base to base. So we were born in Massachusetts and Nebraska and California. I was born in Washington State in Tacoma, along with one of my sisters, and another sister was born in Guam. So we moved to San Antonio for his last base assignment. That was Kelly Air Force Base before it was shut down with the Base Realignment Act. And that was back in 1967. So those are really where my memories started. I have a few from Guam, but grew up in San Antonio, went to public schools, graduated from John Jay High School, John Jay, the first Chief Justice of the United States, and then attended college at James Madison College at Michigan State University. James Madison College, founder of our Constitution, really the major framer of it. And then law school at the University of Texas School of Law, where I had Charles Allen Wright, who most everyone knows as, you know, the author of the Federal Court Treatise and constitutional law professor and well-known among the United States Supreme Court justices. He argued there many. He passed away in 2000, but he's been one of my mentors. Started at Gross, Locke & Hebden in San Antonio, and then in 1991 formed an appellate boutique. We think it's the first in Texas that did nothing but appellate law with Tom Crofts and Sharon Calloway. And that's where I was in practice as a partner in that firm when I went to the Supreme Court in 2001.
Before we jump into your Supreme Court years, pretty early in your career, you were able to argue before the United States Supreme Court. Talk a little bit about that experience, if you don't mind.
Sure. That was a fascinating case. It was a case that I argued in the Fifth Circuit, and it was not very long after the whole Rodney King incident. You remember the police chase, and my case was a police chase case. It didn't have the racial elements, but it was a 1983 action filed by the plaintiff, who was a passenger in a car, who alleged she was removed and injured during the police stop. So that's a case that I argued to the Fifth Circuit, lost 2-1, and then decided, you know, this is a case that maybe the Supreme Court of the United States would take up. So it was the first petition in the Supreme Court that I ever filed, and they granted it. So the first thing I thought about is contacting my former professor, Charles Allen Wright, to see if he could help moot the case, and he did. And this was mid-1990s. I'll give you just a little vignette about it. You know, so Georgetown had by this time already set up a moot court, and you could argue to their moot court program at Georgetown. But I wanted to do it at the University of Texas School of Law, in part because this was around the time that Hopwood was being litigated. Remember, there are some people saying that, you know, really African-Americans should not be at this institution or, you know, or not in the number because they, you know, lack qualifications. And I thought, well, let me show them that there's, you know, a recent graduate. I was 8 years out of law school that is now arguing at the highest court, and open it up for students to watch just to show that as an example that may not necessarily be the case. People can succeed. So Charles Allen Wright put together a moot court, argued it, and he asked, you know, all of the questions that the Supreme Court would ask and more, and really got me ready for my first argument on election day in November of 1996.
You went on to argue the case as a relatively young lawyer, as you pointed out. So what was that experience like? I mean, I'm thinking about being 8 years into your career as a lawyer and taking your place at the lectern in that magnificent building in front of, you know, 9 very interesting personalities, I'm sure. So besides the moot, how did you go about preparing for that at such a relatively young age?
Well, what I did was read every case, you know, 1,000 times, Section 1983 cases that the Supreme Court had addressed, and read the transcripts of all the oral arguments that I could get a hold of, where the current justices had asked questions, worked with my colleagues, and, you know, had other informal moot courts, and, you know, everything you do as an appellate lawyer to get ready for an argument. And then I flew to D.C., and it was my first time ever in Washington, D.C. So that was pretty incredible. I stayed at the Jefferson Hotel just for fun. Really, I didn't know anything about D.C. I had a couple interesting periods before the argument. The argument was on a Tuesday. On Sunday, I think it was, I appeared before Court TV. You remember that podcast? And gave an interview with them. And then I also had an interview in CNN. What I was thinking at the time was, you know, I'll never do this again, probably. I mean, you know, I'll want to, but this is pretty unique. And so when people ask whether they, you know, I could be interviewed, I said yes. Walked into CNN for the interview, and I had to convince them that I was the lawyer that was going to be arguing this case. I think they thought I was too young. And I remember walking into the green room, and Trent Lott was there and William Bennett. They were there to talk about the presidential election. So I got to meet them and then have my interview. And that's Monday night, I guess, is when it was broadcast. And that was the first time that I laid eyes on plaintiff, because they interviewed her as well. The Monday morning, I went to the Supreme Court to hear oral arguments, just so I could get sort of a sense of the courtroom. After that argument, I went up to a U.S. Marshal and I said, look, I'm going to be arguing tomorrow, and you've seen a lot of these arguments. Do you have any advice for me? And, you know, this was a young, not young, but a diminutive U.S. Marshal. She was probably 5'5". And, you know, she kind of looked up to me and she said, well, I'm not a lawyer. I don't really know a lot of what's going on here. She said, but, you know, but I can tell you this, the one thing. She said, I've asked Scalia, you know, how does he know whether, you know, a lawyer who's, you know, arguing here has any experience, knows what they're doing? And she told me that Scalia said, you know, if the lawyer knows that at the podium, there is a handle on the right-hand side of the lectern, and if you twirl that handle, you know, it'll raise the notes or lower your notes. He said, well, that lawyer's probably been here before. You know, the SGs always know. If nothing else, I was prepared and working hard on my opening argument, but that just gave me a little, you know, bit of information that I could use. And so when Chief Justice Rehnquist called the case, you know, the first thing I did was twirl that, you know, that crank. And I don't know if the notes went up or down, but it just kind of made me feel like I was doing. I kind of looked at Scalia and maybe he nodded a little bit and then I could get going. It was a thrilling argument.
If you couldn't tell it was going up or down, maybe you just got punked by the marshal. That's a neat detail.
What everyone says, and it's true, the questions, they come at you right away and they're ferocious and they don't let you go. It's a battle. You feel like you got to hold your own. And I took some advice from Professor Wright. He said, you know, be very careful about conceding points. He said, told me this is going to be a close case and you don't want to lose anyone who's in the middle and they're going to test you. Be very careful. And there's one point where Justice Stevens asked me a hypothetical that seemed to me it was safe to concede. It was so extreme. I said, well, maybe in that event, Justice Stevens. And as soon as I said that, not 2 seconds later, Justice Scalia, you know, jumped up and said, I don't understand why you're conceding this point. You know, just to show that Professor Wright, you know, knew what he was talking about. And you have to be very careful. So that case, the other very, I don't know, dramatic point was they kept asking questions. At the U.S. Supreme Court, you've got to reserve your own rebuttal time. At least I don't recall a yellow light. I knew when there was 10 minutes left, and then there was 8 minutes, and then 5 minutes. In my mind, I was going to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. And then there was 4 and 3, and the questions kept coming, and then 2, and then the time went out. And I'm the petitioner. And it meant that I had waived my rebuttal time completely. And I'm thinking, this is devastating. I was thinking, what are you doing? And so as I'm sitting down, I'm thinking, you know, that was horrible. But then I thought, well, it's also over. At this point, I could just sit back and I don't have to take notes and I can just, you know, relax and hear the rest of the argument. And then there was a point at the very end of adverse counsel's argument where Breyer asked about the record. And it was about the, you know, this was a case where the police officer allegedly committed the violent attack on the passenger, had a record himself. And it was really a series of misdemeanor traffic arrests, and with one incident that you might call violent, and that was a fraternity fight at the University of Oklahoma, long before he was a cadet with the police department. And so Breyer said, is that in the record? And my adverse counsel said, yes, it is. And Breyer said, well, I want to see it. So tell the clerk where it is in the record. And you know, the counsel said, yes, of course I will. And so that argument ended. And as we're approaching each other, you know, he's extending his hand to, you know, congratulate me in the argument. I'm saying, well, congratulations, but it's not in the record. Bring the clerk over. I had a rebuttal, is my point in the end. I had to go back to the court and let them know that this was not in the record. And that was a very important part of the argument.
What do they tell advocates, whether experienced or inexperienced? I mean, if you just continue to get grilled throughout the time of your opening, how do you gracefully end the opening part of your argument so that you do reserve time for rebuttal?
You know, you just have to take control. And I've learned that since. I would have just said at 5 minutes, may I address that on rebuttal? And the chief would have said, that's fine, and then bring the other lawyer to the podium. I should have known that. I didn't. And it's one of those things that you learn in practice. My next argument at the Supreme Court was a couple of years later. And by then, I felt like I had a little bit more command of my argument and how I would address the court. In fact, even at one point, I made the court laugh. Really not intentionally, but I felt, I don't know, comfortable enough to make a point that was somewhat humorous.
One other question I wanted to ask real quick about that whole experience was, you talk about it being sort of like a battle and you're just constantly getting grilled. This is also not a 20-minute argument situation like we commonly have here in our Texas state courts. I can't remember, what's the standard amount of time, or what time were you given for that opening argument?
30 minutes per side.
30. Okay. Well, that's not as bad as I feared it might be, but still 30 minutes of constant peppering is...
It's longer these days, you know, because the court lets it, chief lets it go on longer. But I'll tell you what helps. What helped me, there are a couple points. One was where Rehnquist intervened when Justice Ginsburg was asking a question that, you know, I thought was a little tangential, and Rehnquist agreed. And so that let me get back into my argument. So that was one. And the other was when O'Connor asked a question about the court's charge. And I was so ready for that question because I had, in looking at the transcripts of former oral arguments, it seemed like she always asked that question. She always had some question about the charge and what objection was made and what was the instruction and all of that. And so I had that, you know, I didn't have the whole argument memorized, but I had that portion memorized. So when she asked the question, I just went through, you know, seamlessly. And then that kind of gave me a little bit of confidence to go on the rest of the argument.
You know, speaking of command of the courtroom, I want to transition into your Supreme Court years. You joined the court in 2001, I think. Is that right?
Yes.
When did you decide that you wanted to go that route and become a judge?
Well, it was more a question of getting an offer. So there, first, Raul Gonzalez left the court. That must have been in, I don't know, the late 80s or early, probably 1990, somewhere around there. The late 90s.
I think he was on until, he was my judge, so I should know this.
When I got a call from someone I will not name, but who was not in the Governor Bush's office, but asked me whether I would be interested and replacing Justice Gonzalez. And that went faster than I thought. The sort of activity surrounding replacing that justice, and I kind of hemmed and hawed, thinking, I'm too young, and I know I'm not sure if I'm ready for that, and do I really want to leave San Antonio, and I'm doing this, et cetera, when the replacement was named, and that was Al Gonzalez. And I thought, okay, maybe I had a little bit of an opportunity, but I blew it, and, well, that'll never come again. But then George W. Bush won the White House. And one of his first decisions was to take Al Gonzalez with him to be White House counsel. So there's another vacancy on the court. And this time when I got the call, I thought, I'd ever get three calls for the even the possibility of being on the Supreme Court of Texas. I love appellate work. It would be amazing to be writing the opinions, just being an advocate before the court. And so I sort of leapt on it. And when they asked to come interview, I drove up to Austin and interviewed with Governor Perry. It was the first time I'd met him. And it was an interesting time in Texas because when George W. Bush left, he took a lot of political heavyweights with him. And so Governor Perry was kind of, you know, deciding on his own, you know, what his own path was going to be. So I got an invitation to interview. And I think it was for two reasons. One, John Cornyn, who I knew from San Antonio. He was on the district bench before he was AG. I had that connection, and I think he had a conversation with Perry's office. And Bill Jones was Governor Perry's counsel, general counsel. And I'd known him for a long time as well. I think those two sort of helped put my name in the mix. And I wasn't the only name. There were others. That helped get me the interview to begin with. And ultimately, he asked me to serve.
Am I correct that you were the first African-American justice on the Texas Supreme Court?
Yes, that's correct. That's in 2001. And you think of all the decades, and it was pretty historic. So much so that when this is timely, when I was announced, I think on that same day or that same weekend or a few days later to the San Antonio Spurs game in San Antonio. And, you know, that day my name had been in San Antonio Express News and I was on the cover of the paper, et cetera. A few people recognized me. This one old lady, you know, came up to me and she brought her grandson. And she said, "I just wanted him to meet you. And I'm so honored that, you know, you're going to be on the court." And it just reminded me that this wasn't a trivial thing for people to see that, you know, someone like them could be on the Supreme Court. It struck me as important, not as what I would do in office, but just as a symbol of where we had come in our state and in our country.
Well, to that point, relatedly, you know, you've spoken several times about your personal family heritage and how was your great-great-grandfather or three greats, your third great-grandfather actually was a freed slave, if I remember the story correctly. I've heard you talk about that before, and the whole historic significance of your appointment and then subsequent elections really shouldn't be lost on anyone, considering how you were able to trace that history. Tell us a little about how you found that out, how that's impacted you in your public service.
I would say it started with my father and with Roots. You remember that Alice Haley book and then the TV series in the 1970s where he traced his ancestry back to Africa. And I remember watching that with my father. And we went right around that time and got the old family Bible out where you could see my father's mother and maybe grandfather or grandparents. That's about as far back as in those times. But my father caught the bug, genealogy bug. And so he kept, you know, trying to sleuth, figure out this and that. When I was in law school my first year, and I saw the Texas Genealogical Library and State Archives, I thought this would be a place to look because I wasn't born in Texas, nor my father. His mother was born in Palestine, Texas, in Anderson County. And so there was, you know, generations before her that lived in Texas. And so we decided, let's see what we find out. My grandmother was still living at the time, and she knew who her grandmother was, but not beyond that. We just did a little research in those archives and library and found the name of Shedrick Willis in an obituary. Shedrick Willis was the person you mentioned, my great-great-great-grandfather. And the obituary said, "Shedrick Willis, well-known Negro, dies at age 80 in 1903. And before the war, he was owned by Judge Nicholas W. Battle." And that was the first time we were reading this. And we're like, oh my goodness, this is the first that we knew of. My dad and I were standing there reading this together. So that's how we found out to begin with. And then, you know, you do a little more digging, and there's not a whole lot you can find directly about Shedrick Willis, not right away at least, but you certainly could about Judge Battle. He was a very prominent, he was a colleague of Baylor, I mean, the Baylor of Baylor University in Waco at the time. He was a former district attorney, and then he was district judge, and then he left to fight in the Civil War. And so there's all kinds of information about him. And then digging a little bit more about Willis, we found out that he was a blacksmith. And we knew that because there's in another obituary in the Dallas Morning News, it said, you know, something like this well-known carpenter, you know, had died, but, you know, he in 18, I don't know if it said the year, but before the war, he shod Sam Houston's horse. And he was kind of famous for that. That struck me as very interesting. Anyway, after the war, he had a shop in Waco, and there's an advertisement in the Waco directory that I've got a copy of it on my wall here in the office that says he's blacksmith, wheelwright, and horse chewer. Anyway, so he found a way for the labor to support his family, you know, financially rather than go to an owner. And then the most incredible thing was in the first obituary that I talked about that my father and I read, it said that he served two terms on the Waco City Council after the Civil War. So this is somebody who was, you know, private property one day and a couple of years later, a public servant, a leader, in the community in Waco, Texas. It's just amazing to me that that happened, and that as his descendant, who was owned by a judge, became Chief Justice of Texas. So then I joined the law firm here, Alexander DeBell Jefferson, and that was after I left the court back in 2013. That same year, within months, the firm brought Marcy Hogan Greer to the firm as a partner. She was, you know, an outstanding appellate lawyer and commercial litigator at Fulbright, and then she joined our firm. And then I had a conversation with her one day where she said that she was the great, great, great granddaughter of Sam Houston. So we have that connection that we knew nothing about until, you know, we joined forces as partners at the firm.
History, and it's an amazing thing when you study it and you see paths cross like that. That truly is. I mean, for y'all to be partners now after that, sharing that history is just incredible.
And I'll say, and this is kind of what I will say as president of the American Law Institute, and I'll do that for a long time. You know, today we're in a situation where the country is at odds and everyone is polarized, and you're supposed to be in one camp or the other. And if you're in this camp, you're supposed to hate that camp, and there's no way you can get along. And this is just, to me, this story is a symbol of our nation overcoming those sorts of divisions and finding ways to work together and to compromise no matter what happened before. And that's, to me, our Constitution and our history bring that is unique in the world. And we shouldn't despair. Even today, we shouldn't despair that we can find ways to work together in a very productive way, no matter what our differences. It's one reason I was so happy to be elected to be president of the American Law Institute, because it's an organization where there are fierce disagreements about the law. And these are very important debates where, you know, there are advocates all sides, but they come together. They're excellent lawyers, professors, and judges, and hash it out in a civil way and make some compromises. And hopefully, if the job is done right, are producing products of a more modern and clear law that is, you know, to the benefit of lawyers, but more importantly, to the lawyers' clients, you know, that are dealing with these very serious disputes.
Well, we wanted to talk with you in detail about your ALI presidency. And so that's seems like a good segue into that part of the conversation. How did you first get involved in ALI? And maybe a quick summary of those of us who are lawyers certainly know what it is, but for maybe those who don't or don't appreciate it, tell us what ALI does.
Well, first, I didn't know what ALI was, but I knew what the Restatement of Torts was. That was kind of our Bible, you know, in torts class in law school. I knew who Dean Keaton was, you know, who was a reporter for the Torts Project. And through that, I think I learned about ALI. And I already mentioned Charles Allen Wright was my professor. He's my professor for constitutional law for federal courts and for a Supreme Court seminar where each one of us played the role of a sitting U.S. Supreme Court justice. And we decided the cases that were court that term. The sources were restatement provisions. And that's when I learned about Charles Allen Wright's involvement. He was president of the American Law Institute, my former professor. I always held it in high regard. And then Professor Wright had the idea, as he was president, to make sure that the justices of the Supreme Court of Texas were members of the American Law Institute. Because what the Institute does is work to modernize and improve and clarify the law for the better administration of justice. Itself law. And so the only way it is adopted is through court. And one of the best ways for its adoption to occur is through Supreme Courts, either the Supreme Court of the United States or the Supreme Courts of the states and territories. And so one of his projects was to make sure that Supreme Court justices became members of the American Law Institute so they would study the work. And if they believed that it was an accurate portrayal of the law, adopt it in their states. And that way it would resonate, you know, nationally. That was Professor Wright's plan. And although he died in 2000, it became very clear to me that it was also Tom Phillips and Nathan Hex and others on the court's adoption of that. You know, so they encouraged me to accept a nomination if it happened. And I was nominated to be a member and then elected. And that was in 2001, shortly after I came to the court. And started going to the meetings and was just fascinated with what happens at those meetings. It's you walk into a big room, you know, where there's 1,000 people and there are microphones and there are reporters that are talking about their project. It might be torts or property or contracts or conflict of laws or Uniform Commercial Code is a joint project of ALI and the Uniform Law Commission. So those are the topics. And then you see walking up to the podium, the people you read about every day as a law student and as a lawyer, the famous judges and the great lawyers and the professors of, you know, high esteem. And they're just debating these very, you know, important principles, debating something that you're working on. And you start understanding that there's a great source of information that is much bigger than maybe you were looking at as a law student or as a lawyer. And the level of sophisticated argument is so much higher. I was intrigued by that and loved being part of that process. As a member, you can contribute and you comment on draft, and they're considered seriously. If you're serious, you know, if the questions that you're asking or the suggestions that you're making are serious, they're going to be really debated. So that's what made me excited. And so I was happy to be a member from 2001. I just celebrated my 25th anniversary, 25 years with ALI in 2026. And just a couple of weeks ago was officially installed as president of the Institute.
For most clients, supersedeas bond is something they may need once in a lifetime. What's at stake can be very significant. Very few surety brokers specialize in supersedeas bonds, so it's important to work with a company that knows the ins and outs of the process. If you have a client needing to stay enforcement of a judgment in Texas or any other state or federal court, contact Court Surety Bond Agency today.
Where do you see the ALI kind of going moving forward? Is their mission going to remain the same? I mean, especially when we have things like AI coming into the profession, do you see them kind of intersecting with that?
So everything is changing in the law, and AI is a big reason for that. So yes, this is something that the Institute is going to be grappling with for a long time, but hopefully in a productive way. So one thing that the ALI does, we're not a tech company, we're an ideas company, and our model is to share the information. After this process, we go through this process, we want people to read it and to apply it. And what AI does is accelerate, you know, that process. We're not really a publisher, but our products are published. And now in publication, everything is available because you have all these, you know, companies out there and bots and AI, ChatGPT and Claude and everyone else. That's all they do is they gather all this information, but they don't always do it accurately is the problem. And we know that with hallucinations and court opinions, it's true also for ALI. So one thing that I think we can start concentrating on is being the gold standard, you know, to make sure that if you're citing our work, maybe there's some way to make sure that it is the work, that it is accurate and make sure it's available to them.
Yeah, that's a big deal.
So those are some of the things we're working on. Also, we've got a project looking at, like in tort, where does AI come into that? So you've got autonomous vehicles that are involved in accidents. You know, you can't, what's the standard for reasonable autonomous driver? You know, I mean, what does it mean to be negligent? You know, if you're a technology. So there are all kinds of interesting things that AI is looking at with respect to artificial intelligence right now.
How do you balance, how does ALI intend to balance this, the incredibly rapid pace at which the technology is developing? I mean, everything I hear and read is we're going to get to, you know, agentic super intelligence within a much shorter period of time than anyone would have suspected even 5 years ago. You know, ALI, as I understand it, from as how you've described it, is there's a lot of study involved and recommendation and discussion and debate. That is a great process. I just wonder about how there's going to be time to do that when the technology is just blowing past everybody.
So that's exactly right. But we also have in ALI the lawyers and the professors and the judges that are working on these issues every day. General counsel and the judges who are presiding over these cases, the lawyers who are presenting them, patent lawyer, you know, so I don't actually know the answer, but do know that we can tap into their expertise. They're members because they are excellent in what they do, and they can help advise us on how to work through these issues. And, you know, tomorrow there might be, we open the paper, and you won't open papers anymore, but you'll get something on your phone that says there's a whole new huge development that some AI company has developed that's going to change everything. So I don't know. We're going to have to act faster than we have in the past and adapt more quickly, but never give up the quality, the intense analytical work that human beings can do, I think, still in many ways better than machines. And I don't know how long that will be true, but the human dimension, there always needs to be, I think, just for morality, you know, for humanity, there's got to be a human being involved in everywhere that AI exists. And I think that's especially true in the law. So it's a good question, and it's not answered today. And I think it's going to be, we're just going to keep working on it.
How long is your presidency?
It's a 3-year term with a 3-term max. So, maximum 9 years. We just celebrated in 1923, 100 years of ALI. It was established in 1923. William Howard Taft was involved, and the leaders of the law in that era who understood the law was being developed in different ways in different states and territories and state and federal court, and it was becoming a mess. And so we had to have some way to at least think about uniformity. And those founders understood it wouldn't mean that ALI could dictate to any court, what the black letter would be in law, but they could offer best practices, best codes to courts. And we're now bringing it to legislatures and our principles projects to make, again, for the better administration of justice. And I think that general idea still holds true today. And I hope we can use that to tackle all of these new iterations and new technologies that are coming to bear.
Well, it's an exciting time for you to take the leadership of ALI, and I'm sure somewhat stressful with all of this stuff coming on the horizon, or even, like you say, every day you just open an app on your phone and you've got some new breaking news about some technological development. So, those terms, 2 subsequent terms, it does provide the opportunity for some continuity of leadership. I'd say, again, congratulations, and maybe I'm sorry.
I'll tell the audience listening to this, send me ideas. And send ALI ideas. That our director of ALI is Diane Wood. She's a former chief judge of the 7th Circuit Court of Appeals, graduate, coincidentally, of the University of Texas School of Law. Her professor was also Charles Allen Wright. So we've got some Texas connections in ALI, but our reach spans throughout from coast to coast and international. And we're looking for the best and the brightest comments on projects and new projects that maybe we should be taking up. I'm all ears. And I think that is the strength of our organization, and that is the participation on a voluntary basis, of the best and the brightest in our profession.
While we're kind of talking about futurism and kind of where the law is headed, one of the big achievements, I think, when you were Chief Justice is starting cameras in the courtroom and streaming oral arguments. And I guess now we're almost 20 years into that. I mean, how did you see that change? Did you see a change in the way that lawyers acted and all that? Because I think that's always been a fear at the U.S. Supreme Court. I'm just curious about your experience.
The biggest change I saw was in the way judges acted. And I'll say it in this way. When you know that there are going to be cameras in the courtroom, you have an incentive to be more prepared for oral arguments. It made me, I would say, hypersensitive to being as prepared as I could be so that my questions were intelligent, to show that I understood what was going on in the case. And I think that was true of my colleagues as well. So that's number one. I think it was very good for the court and as an institution be even better or more fully engaged in the argument process, which is important to lawyers, but again, ultimately very important to the clients, to know that when they had their day in court, it was completely a thorough examination and fair of both sides. So that's one. The second thing I would say is, we were warned that lawyers would play to the cameras, right? And this is a fear that, people talk about at the U.S. Supreme Court too, that that'll be the ultimate impact. I think both of you know, and the audience out there who are appellate lawyers know, and that's really hard to do because you can start, and I can remember one example of what I thought was a lawyer trying to play to the camera. They start that way, but then the questions come. And you have to answer the questions, and it doesn't, it's not a jury argument, and doesn't matter how much you flail your arms, the question, it's more of an intellectual exercise. It's somewhat academic. The premium is placed on preparation. The judges are prepared, but the lawyers know the record and the law. They're going to be much more effective at the podium than they would be with a motion. So very quickly, you're centered on the right thing in an oral argument. And that happens whether the cameras are there or not. But what the cameras do is open the process to the public. Public can see law at work. And it opens the process to law students, who want to see how an appellate argument plays out and how they could do, how they could be an appellate lawyer themselves. And it opens it up to journalists who you know, now if you're a journalist in El Paso, you don't have to drive down or fly down to Austin, Texas to see what's happening. And it opens it up to the legislature. You know, they see that some of these, maybe there's a statutory fix and they can watch, you know, the debate about a statute that they helped, you know, put in place. And so there's so many different ways that this benefits, I think, the public and the development of the law. If you have a case that has some relationship to one that's going to be argued next week, you're going to watch, won't you? Because you're curious how this is going to impact your case that's either in the trial court or the Court of Appeals, maybe ultimately to the Supreme Court. So it helps develop a lot more intense interest in what the court does. And on top of that, I think it wouldn't have been as effective to open it up, you know, to oral arguments and put cameras in the courtroom if we hadn't also, a couple of years after cameras, made electronic filing available to everyone. And so now you can watch the argument, but you can also read all the briefs. You know, you can pull them up in an instant. And that, I think, was, again, we can't be transparent about everything. The kind of transparency that makes, I think, you have a greater appreciation of what the lawyers and are having to go through and what the judges are facing with these complex arguments. It enhances faith in the court system. I think that's important because that's what we rely on. The judges, it's often said, and it's true, you know, you don't have power of the sword. You know, you don't have the power of the purse. It's the opinions, it's the judgment that you release that are important.
I've been really pleased at how the Supreme Court's adoption of video at oral argument has sort of trickled down to the intermediate courts of appeals too. It's good and bad. I mean, as an advocate, you get to go back and critique yourself, I guess, and it's preserved for posterity, rightly or wrongly or good or bad. But that's been a really nice benefit. And I know the Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court has resisted it, but I think, you know, the Texas Supreme Court, yeah, okay, it's a state Supreme Court, but, you know, the issues that come before that court are hugely important and lots of dollars at stake. And sometimes they involve, you know, big time political issues. And, but for, you know, the national media, maybe the coverage is not the same, in your former court, but it's difficult for me to really understand, other than just not wanting to do it or, you know, just history, why the U.S. Supremes would be so resistant to it. If there is a way to do it, you can't prevent someone from grandstanding or showboating, but the people who appear in that court on a regular basis, it seems to me that wouldn't want to be the reputation that you would want to get as an advocate there, is someone who's playing to the camera.
Yes, you know, but on the other hand, and this was true of the court, at the same time that I'm opening up the court for cameras, I'm also enhancing security at the court itself, because the Supreme Court of Texas got threats, judges do. Well, the U.S. Supreme Court, I mean, that's an exponentially, I think, more dangerous aspect of their jobs. You get these people that are just crazy. You know, we've heard about people outside of Kavanaugh's office, I mean, home, you know, we can't imagine what kinds of threats they get that are serious, where you really need the U.S. Marshals to become involved. And so the more, you know, public you are, the more you expose yourself to these sorts of potential threats. And so there's a lot more, I think, to go. So there, you have to think about it in terms of balance. They have opened up. You remember when we first started practicing, or at least when I first started practicing, you wouldn't have access to even audio tapes. Those were only reserved for academic studies, for professors could come and listen to some of those tapes, but they were prohibited. The public was prohibited from accessing those generally. So there's been a whole lot of opening up about at least the access to the audio of Supreme Court arguments. I think that's been a huge step. And I would also say, I would not have wanted anyone else to order the court to do this. You know, I think it's a third branch decision whether it is something that ought to be done. And so read about, you know, efforts to force the U.S. Supreme Court to do this or that. I don't think that's right at all. I think that's got to come from the court itself, understanding, you know, all the pros and cons. It's not just about people being flashy at arguments, but it's about a lot more. The dignity of the court, they have traditions that are important that we want to see maintained, and about safety and all those issues. And that's got to be a conversation that the justices themselves have. That's my opinion anyway.
We do, in the meantime, there are podcasts out there that reproduce the audio. OEA is one of them. It's a helpful listen if you want to hear what actually happens inside the courtroom at the Supreme Court. And to the point about Supreme Court arguments, kind of the worry about it becoming performance art, I'm not going to say it's completely illegitimate. We've seen an example in the media recently that even resulted in a TED Talk coming out of the big redistricting case from Louisiana. I think Neil Katyal was taking a lot of credit on Twitter and ultimately in his TED talk for how much his advocacy helped sway the result in that case. I guess anybody could do that, you know, with or without cameras, but I don't mean to be dismissive of any concerns about that. It just seems like I understand and agree with your point about, you know, history and tradition when it comes to maintaining the dignity of the institution. And there's still, to some degree, people can still go and say things after the fact, like that particular advocate did. You know, there's been a lot of commentary made about that.
That's true. I'm still a fan. I think it's still good. And I think it's good for all the reasons that I mentioned. But in the end, I think that I'll say this. When the public, it's like when you ask a juror, what was your experience? You know, you sat through the trial and you rendered a verdict. And now you ask them a week or two later and they say this was a powerful experience. It really impresses them that the legal system works and that it is serious and it's important, you know, for a person to have their day in court. I think the same is true when you watch these oral arguments. There are a lot of caricatures about justices on the Supreme Court of the United States and justices on the Supreme Court of Texas. You have caricatures and people are quick to read a headline and come to an opinion about the all-Republican Supreme Court or whatever it is. But when you have the access to watch them as much as you can do their work, you see that often they're grappling with very important questions about what a statute means or where the common law is headed or the tension between a farmer and, you know, an urban business on water rights or, you know, whatever it is. These are very hard questions. And you see the court trying to work through them. I just think it helps as kind of a civic education. It helps people understand their democracy better.
This question relates to the topics we've been discussing. I mean, it seems like we've covered two major accomplishments that happened while you were Chief Justice. We talked about cameras in the Supreme Court courtroom, and I think you're right. I think that certainly helped the court's appearance of transparency and has been a really good thing overall. And you also mentioned e-filing. I mean, those are both, you know, significant developments that happened during your time as Chief. So you've certainly left your mark in that way. Is there anything else during your time as the Chief Justice of Texas that you're particularly proud of that the court accomplished?
Well, yes. Maybe even bigger than those two is access to justice. We worked very hard on establishing a relationship with the legislature in which the legislature promoted access to justice. We had never had direct appropriations from the legislature to legal aid in the time before 2000, I think it was 2011 or so, and argued to the legislature, you know, this was during a time there was an economic crisis in 2008, and the IOLTA programs were just plummeting because the interest rates were going down and down and down, and that's what funded legal aid programs through our IOLTA programs. And so I was talking to the legislature that all the money that was there is drying up. And so there are people who are now no longer able to protect their basic civil rights, civil legal needs. That year, the legislature appropriated, you know, millions of dollars, and they haven't stopped since then. And that's let more people get their rights. Where you can't afford a lawyer, where else do you turn but to, you know, pro bono or legal aid organizations to do so? And if you don't have funding, most of our legal needs can't be met. And it's not just for poor people, for people who are middle class. You know, you can't afford a lawyer to argue about the fence that, you know, fell down in your backyard, you know, or you're a small business and you're sued for breach of contract. You know, so that's one thing that you put on the table for all branches, legislative, executive, and judicial, that we have to do better about making the law accessible to all of us, whether you're rich or poor or in between. So I think that was a major accomplishment. And then one thing people don't really know is the court has its docket and decides cases, but the Chief Justice also goes to the legislature to talk about the general administration of justice. Is it working? And I'll just leave you with one other example of that, and that was in the area of juvenile justice. There was 2000s, it started in the 90s, more and more, you know, police officers on campus that were issuing tickets to kids, Class C misdemeanor tickets for violating school codes. And I'm talking about things like yelling at the teacher or a fight in the hallway or wearing the wrong clothes. Those sorts of things were resulting in tickets. And I went and visited a juvenile court and to see what does that mean? And that means single mothers have to come to court and try to argue their case without a lawyer to get a ticket dismissed, or, you know, it's a $200 ticket, whatever it is that they can't afford. And many of these kids wound up being, you know, suspended or expelled. And so we had a public hearing at the Supreme Court to say, does this really make sense? And then I could take the results of that hearing, go to the judicial council, which is the policymaking arm of the judiciary, and think about, you know, going to legislators and saying this needs to be reformed. Anyway, the bottom line is it was. And from one year to the next, there were hundreds of thousands of fewer of these tickets being given. It meant kids were staying in school longer. There are things like that courts can do that are outside of the docket, but important to the overall legal landscape. Chief Justice especially can be doing out there. So things like that, I think, are important. And Chief Justice Heck, you know, continued all of those programs and more. He also looked at mental anguish. He looked at what does the court do during a COVID-19 situation when all the courts are closed, but trials need to keep going. And again, those are not specifically docket type things, but there are ways to keep our legal system healthy so that they, you know, can react to the legitimate needs of Texas citizens.
One thing that I think you've spoken out since your time on the bench and other former chiefs have as well is partisan judicial elections. I mean, do we think that's going to change realistically in Texas anytime soon?
Likely not, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't keep talking about it. You know, we will have an election coming up, and this has happened before where, you know, potentially just because of what happens at the top of the ticket, you know, many talented judges lower down or swept out of office, not because they were bad at the work or they were slow or inefficient, but because for that year, you know, they had the wrong political affiliation by their name. That still doesn't make sense to me. We shouldn't have that kind of system. I have no problem with a smart, hardworking Democratic judge, even though I was, I hope, a smart, hardworking Republican judge. We want the judges that are going to apply the law as objectively as they possibly can, Republican or Democrat. And they shouldn't be swept out because, you know, some of the top of the ticket, you know, sort of taking the wind out of their sails. So one of the problems is it focuses less on merit than it does on party affiliation. And if it doesn't focus on party affiliation, then it focuses on the sound of your name. You know, Jefferson was a good name. Yackel was not. Travis County, you know, it's hard to win with that name. You great judge, federal district judge, now retired. But that's just an example. So if it's not co-affiliation or the sound of your name, then it comes down to how much money you can raise and get on TV. And if you think about it, none of those tells you sound of your name, political affiliation, money, none of those say whether you're going to be a good judge. And that's the problem. We need to focus more on the merit of an experience of a judge than those, you know, other factors.
Appellate filing requires precision. A small mistake could derail your case. That's why you need Counsel Press, trusted by 100% of the Am Law 100 firms since 1938. Whether it's e-brief preparation, indexing, or electronic filing, they provide complete support, ensuring every document meets the highest standards of accuracy and compliance. Their dedicated team of appellate counsel and paralegal specialists guide your case through every step. From review to filing, Counsel Press has your back. Visit counselpress.com to learn how they can support your next appeal.
Well, Chief Justice Jefferson, this has been a great conversation. We've certainly enjoyed spending time with you this afternoon, and thank you for all your time and willingness to come on and talk with us. Congratulations again on your ALI election as president. That's an exciting thing to have happen, and look forward to monitoring, watching your leadership in that organization for the next several years. Before we let you go, our tradition is to ask our guest for a tip or a war story. It could be related to appellate practice, and you're certainly well-suited to provide that. We haven't really talked that much about appellate practices per se, because we've had so many other good topics to cover. I think it's going to be great for our listener. But do you have a tip or a war story to share as we part?
Well, I'll tell you this war story, and it's related to the petition that was granted for my first case before the U.S. Supreme Court. So this was a case where I represented Bryan County, Oklahoma, and it was the police pursuit excessive force case, and we were defending that case. Our side lost at the district court, a jury verdict. And so we appealed, and I lost 2-1 at the Fifth Circuit. And so then I tell the client, we should take this up to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, this is a public entity. I'm talking to the commissioner's court in Oklahoma. And they go to me and they say, look, we keep losing. We're spending public funds on this lawsuit. And they say, we're not going to spend more public money to keep losing. And they say, no, thank you. And so then I go back to them maybe a few days later, the next week. And I said, look, I believe in this case. And I think we've got a real shot at the Supreme Court. So let's do this. Don't pay me. You know, I will file the petition for cert for free and we'll resume, you know, the billing relationship if they grant the petition. So they said under those circumstances, yes, you can file that petition. I say that as a, I guess, as a way to say, find your own way. You don't know where it's going to go. But as a lawyer, you know, if you believe in a case, find a way to get it presented and take risks, take some risk. And sometimes they pay off. If I had just let it stop, we're not going to take it to the Supreme Court. I probably never would have gotten on Governor Perry's radar as an appellate advocate. But I wasn't thinking that then. But, you know, I'm just saying, you know, just take some risks and take some chances, you know, believe in yourself. And it's not empty belief. You know, you do the work to have the experience, but believe in yourself and take risks and they ultimately can pay off or make you feel better about yourself anyway.
Well, we certainly appreciate that piece of advice and certainly have, you know, you've got the benefit of all your experience in presenting that to our listeners and watchers. And thank you again, Judge, for being with us.
Thanks for what you're doing. It was important for the court to have cameras in the courtroom. It's important to the public also to have broadcasts, podcasts like this that delve into, you know, what we do as lawyers and what happens in appellate courts. And the more exposure that the legal profession has to the public, the better. They understand there's a place to go in which if you have the law behind your side and a good advocate, you can prevail. And against all odds. And you're telling those stories through these podcasts. So thank you for what you're doing.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by LawPods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.